Thanks for listening to the Dusty and Cam in the Morning podcast, brought to you by your local Les Schwab Tire Centers, where I get my wild country tires. Les Schwab, doing the right thing since 1952.
This is Dusty and Cam in the Morning with Dusty Hera and NFL veteran Cam Cleland.
I'm the best ever. I'm the most brutal in Michigan, most ruthless champion there's ever been. There's no one can stop me.
On 1080.
I'm the best ever.
The Fan.
All right, hour number three of Dusty and Cam in the Morning. Thanks for being with us. All right, we've been talking a lot about college football. The entire 7 o'clock hour, the We Are United movement joining the We Want to Play movement in the prospects of what college football may look like in 2020 as conference commissioners are meeting, university presidents are meeting over the next couple of days to determine whether or not the fall schedule will be just be pushed all the way out to the spring. To shed a little bit of light on it, man who broke the story on the Big Sky, bumping their conference to the spring and has been all over the We Are United movement is Kyle Bonagura of ESPN, and he joins us now. Good morning, Kyle. How's it going, man?
I'm doing good, guys. Thanks for having me.
Last time that I talked to you, you were going to be a father-to-be, and I think I just told you, like, get used to not having sleep. How is that going?
Yeah, so I was up from about 3 a.m. to 4:30 a.m. last night trying to get our little guy to calm down. He's actually been pretty good, but I'm certainly learning the last couple of days that it's not all smooth sailing.
You know, it's not, but hey, thank you for waking up on a short night's sleep and joining us, because I've been there. I've been through it. It does get better. Hopefully it gets better soon. But right now it's a weird time because, like, you probably checked your phone at some point when you were up, and there's something always new coming out about the season in college football. First, especially with the Pac-12, I mean, I don't even know where we start, but just the prospects of a season, it just is seemingly more and more unlikely that a fall schedule happens. Where do we stand right now in your mind?
Yeah, I think at this point, every day for the last maybe 2 weeks, I've been less and less optimistic that we'll play football this fall. And today, that still holds true. I mean, I would be surprised at this point if there is a college football season in the fall. And I want to be clear that I'm not completely writing it off at this point. I think the way things have changed so quickly over the last couple months, you have to allow for the possibility they could swing back the other direction. But I just don't see it happening at this point. I'm expecting a fall is football.
You know, with
football is fall. There we go.
Which is a weird thing to think about, because it's been our blanket. It's been our little woogie that we've carried around with us for so long, is that you wait for the summer months and kind of those dog days of summer, and then football's back and we have college football to root for. How much of this that is in play do you think is kind of forced by the players having a voice now and saying, we want mandates? Because it feels as if, like, the leagues were all gung-ho, we're going to go and play, and then the players started speaking up saying, hey, we want something uniform to happen across all of the Power Five. Do you think that is making the decision, or is this just strictly the leagues were on this path before that We Are United and We Want to Play joined forces?
Yeah, so I think it's important to preface all this with there are so many moving pieces here, yeah. And to assign value to what's more important to going in which direction is very difficult, right? You have to really step back and take a 30,000 foot view and try to really understand things. But I certainly think that with so many different factors playing in, you have, just let's talk Pac-12 United first, right? There was the need for better COVID protocols from the player's standpoint. They wanted the social justice issues to be addressed more seriously from the conference, which actually the Pac-12 has done a pretty good job of. There are economic factors that weighed into that, and then several other demands that they called them in their letter that was released last week. If any of those issues had popped up on their own, it would have been tough for everyone to unite and create a kind of a movement, right? But because you have so many important issues coming to light, roughly at the same time, it was a lot easier for the group to unify, because then everyone's got their own priorities, right? And so, but when you have so many important issues happening at the same time, it's easier to kind of link hands and say, yeah, we're all in this together for all of these reasons. And so I think that's kind of made it easier for the group to just exist in the first place. And now that they gained some momentum and really, you know, you started seeing other conferences follow suit with similar we are united statements across the country. You know, then you get to the point where they're also like, hey, we also are football players. We do want to play. This isn't ultimately about not playing football. It's about, you know, making sure that, you know, we're not left in the cold and just being used for our ability to play football. Like all the other things need to be part of this deal. And so it's all of that, right? It's we want to play football. However, there's a bunch of other important factors that need to be addressed at the same time. So again, I do think it's important to understand that you're not going to get everyone to agree on everything, right? But you have so many players with so many different priorities to them. And a lot of different things link those together. So I don't know if that, you know, was the best way to answer your question, but I do think it's important to look at all the different factors that are trying to work at the same time. It's just tough to do.
Kyle Bonagura is our guest. He covers the Pac-12 for ESPN. Now, before the We Are United and the We Want to Play joined forces late last night, Pac-12 Commissioner Larry Scott, the athletic directors for Utah, Arizona State, and then one other conference administrator, they jumped on a conference call with the We Are United Pac-12 front on Thursday night. And initial reports are that, hey, it was a cordial conversation that they had. Well, the players have started speaking up, and it doesn't seem that way. Could you kind of shed a little light on what the players are feeling coming out of that conversation that they had with Larry Scott?
Yeah, so I think there's mixed opinions on the tenor of that. I think if you talk to people at the conference office, they they thought it was, you know, it was a fine meeting. The way they represented it, it was this productive, cordial, and productive conversation. The players really felt disrespected during the meeting is my main takeaway. They felt like it was kind of a no-show meeting on the Pac-12 standpoint, Larry Scott in particular, that they really weren't taking things seriously. And you know, of course, it's probably somewhere in the middle, right? You know, it's one extreme and the other extreme. It's probably somewhere in the middle. But what the players had a problem with is that, you know, Larry comes from a place where he surrounds himself by a lot of people who are yes, sir, Larry. What do you want, Larry? It's a top down hierarchy in the Pac-12 conference, and he's not used to being challenged very often. He's being used to being told that he'll get whatever he wants from the people that he surrounds himself by. And when he's challenged by a bunch of student athletes on a call like this, you know, that's an unusual position for him. And so I don't think he responded at times the best way that he could have. It sounds like he was getting rattled, especially deep in the call. It was a 2-hour call. Mm-hmm. I think at the start it was going fine. And then as things kind of progressed, people lost their composure a little bit. I don't think there was any yelling or anything like that. But, you know, when Larry told a Utah player, Nick Ford, that he was talking out of both sides of his mouth, that didn't sit well with the players. That came off as very disrespectful. I was told that he told the players to drop the facade about this being about COVID restrictions or protocols. And, you know, that's not going to sit well with the players either. Telling them that, you know, this is about acquiring generational wealth, you're wasting your time, is just a kind of a weird thing to say when you're sitting on a $5.3 million annual salary. Wow. to run a conference that has been, you know, not as prominent in his tenure as it was previously. There's just a lot going on there to kind of digest.
Wow. That is, I mean, and those are sort of some of the sorts of things that you hear, like as far as negotiations go and stuff, that kind of it's always everybody falls in line with Larry Scott and that yes men mentality that you were talking about. Well, the kids were saying, from what I read from, you know, your piece and others, is that it kind of felt like he was unprepared for what they were going to bring forth. And that is an amazing kind of tenor to have out of a conversation like that, is you should be the guy that has the answers of what the kids are looking for. And I saw that what was the kid's name? The Ford kid from Utah. His
Nick Ford,
yeah, it was a follow-up, right? To a question of, so what is going to be covered in our scholarships? And that was the talking out of both sides of your mouth. And you sit there and you go, all right, this has gotten ugly for the Pac-12, but unifying those voices together, do you think that maybe there's going to be a better resolution to this now that guys like Trevor Lawrence, the ACC, Big Ten, SEC, and Big 12 are involved in it as well?
See, what's complicated, right, is because when you have so many different groups of people, that's why college sports is so much more difficult in this time than professional sports. I mean, there's a number of reasons, but you have, when you have, 130 FBS programs, you have, 10 conferences in the independents. You have the NCAA, you have, two levels of conferences with the Power Five and the Group of Five. Then trying to get everyone on the same page is just so difficult to do. And trying to find some uniform protocols for all of the issues that are being raised across all of those different institutions involving multiple government entities, private academic institutions. You have universities that university presidents who have different priorities. Of course, college football is such a regional sport in terms of how it's prioritized in different places in the country. You know, where I live in the Bay Area down in California, college football is not the same as it is in much of Oregon, right? Or in the South, where it kind of replaces the pro football aspect. So because there's so many competing factors there, I don't see how you're able to find a resolution for this college football season with all of those, for all of these issues. Could you still find a way to play football? Yeah, sure, you can do that. But these issues aren't going away anytime soon. And I'm having trouble seeing how, without, a complete restructure of the sport, how they ever do, really.
Right. And, there are some things that, in the initial list of demands, quote unquote demands that they had, there were some things that I thought were really common sense and smart as far as safety protocols and what some of the things the players were looking for. But then in my mind, there's a lot of non-starters there. 50-50 revenue split, asking, for 2 or 3% of any revenues to go, out of the school's pockets when you're so far behind from the Big Ten and the SEC and the splits of all the other conferences. I think those were really tough to kind of seem as realistic. Do you get the sense that the players feel that way? Like some of the things that they were just shooting for the moon, knowing that there was never going to happen with like a 50-50 split of revenue, or are they steadfast in that where they have a belief that they can get 50-50 of the revenue?
No, I mean, they knew there was going to be no chance that they got 50-50 revenue, but at the same time, they also wanted to be taken. They wanted their movement to be acknowledged, right? And right. It certainly worked for that. I mean, it was certainly noteworthy. I mean, we're talking about it. We're not the only ones who are talking about the 50-50 revenue ask that was included in the Players Tribune article. That was picked up, all over the place, not mm-hmm. just media, but just people talking, right? You're talking about it with your friends or whatever the situation might be. I certainly think, and I think that's one other addition from the conversation, Larry Scott told the players that they handled it poorly, they got bad advice, and that he referred to it as a PR stunt. Oof. And it's a bad thing to say in the meeting. Like, what's the point of that? It just leads to more, it's just a combative tone to the call. But also, like, you also understand if you put yourself on his side, yeah, it was the 50-50 revenues part was for public relations reasons, right? Mm-hmm. It was to get people to read and understand more of what's going on. It was never realistic, but it's also like, what negotiation starts where you think you're going to get everything you want? Like, why? Well, like, it doesn't hurt them to throw in something that was, way above what was, in the realm of possibility. So anyone who was like really criticizing like the 50-50 revenue split, let's just take it down a notch, understand that was that's just part of a strategy to, gain a foothold for the other things more than really thinking that that's going to happen. At the same time, they do have a point that if you look at over at college football over the past, 20 years or so, there have been increases in, full cost of attendance and additional meals. And there have been some concessions and additional, things added to what's included in the scholarship, but it's still not a full market value, to what the college players are bringing in at the same time. And I think that's really the point that they're addressing here is that, listen, like, we are worth more than we are getting. And you can't really think of another, another faction of society where, you're paid so much less than what full market value is, or don't even have the opportunity to pursue it.
Kyle Bonagura of ESPN. He covers the Pac-12. Always appreciate the time, man. Hopefully the next time we have you on, we can talk about some really positive stuff around, maybe football returning and sports returning and all that stuff. But in the meantime, I really appreciate your insight on all this stuff, and keep up the great work, and try to get some sleep, dude.
I'll try very hard to get some sleep. I'm taking a nap right now, but then I'll probably miss the college football season being canceled or something like that. So I got to stay awake.
All right.
Thanks for having me. Good talking to you as always.
Yeah. Have a good one, man. We'll just have Buck send him a text. Buck, make sure you text him. If anything happens in the next couple of hours, just be like, dude, you got to wake up.
Dude, get up.
Yep. So Kyle Bonagura, I mean, and that is, The reason why I wanted to have Kyle on is to shed light as to what really is going on with the Pac-12 players and that call with Larry Scott on Thursday. Like, we all read it, we all see it, that it's not looking good for the fate of college football to be played in the fall. But there's some points that he raised where he's talking to these student athletes and he's getting their, you know, comments on what happened in that call, that 2-hour call on Thursday night with Larry Scott. And it just always highlights the kind of dysfunction that the Pac-12 has, right? And it was a, at times, just kind of belittling the idea that they wanted to move forward with some real changes in college sports. And he's not taking it seriously. And so now they united with the, we want to play, and all five power conferences are one in a unified voice moving forward. Great stuff from Kyle Bonagura of ESPN. Check him out on Twitter at Bonagura ESPN. All right, let's talk some Blazers, shall we? We've had a lot of college football news over the course of the show today. We got a couple good case of the Mondays as well. But unpacking the Blazers weekend, bright spots and big flaws highlighted in a Saturday, Sunday back-to-back. Dusty and Cam on the Fan. All right, it is 8:21. Keep sending your case of the Mondays in. Let her rip, folks. It's okay to have them. That's fine. This case of the Mondays came in and said, I'm not realizing my dog needed to go out and stepping in a big fat dump at the top of the stairs and walking all the way down the stairs before I realized what I'd done. My fault, and a great start to Monday.
Oh, boy. So, hold on. I'm wondering, were there shoes there, or are there just calluses built up on these feet so much you don't feel the poop?
That's got to be a shoe. Yeah, like you don't step barefoot onto a turd or even socked on a turd and not know you did
but
it.
But I still feel like you'd like, wouldn't you slip or slide a little bit? Like a little squishy?
I don't know. It depends on how high the fiber content is of your dog's diet, I guess. But unless you have really squishy carpet, I guess, maybe you wouldn't notice it. I don't know. That's a terrible start to the day, though.
That's not good, especially the tracking it around. One pile, fine. But if you leave 12 steps of it, that's not great.
You end up on all fours. It's just a, my God, you're scrubbing the carpet in the morning. It's not a good start to your day, but hey, what a great wake-up call, huh? You're definitely going to be awake after that. All right, if you missed our interview with Kyle Bonagura of ESPN, covers the Pac-12, some really fascinating stuff about not just what the college football landscape looks like right now, but the fact that Larry Scott and his handling of a conference call that he had with players. I mean, there's some things that Kyle said that you just sit there and you go, what good does that do in a conversation with anybody to sit there and say, drop the facade? You know, you guys are looking for generational wealth and that's not going to happen. Or, you know, just talking out of both sides of your mouth. I can understand that, but not in the context of what happened, because Nick Ford was just asking for clarification on a scholarship and what will be honored and what won't be not honored.
Well, that's the thing is I think some of those comments are really eye-opening. Now, listen, like I think it's been like, it's almost become sport for Pac-12 fans to just rail on Larry Scott because it's easy. He's he's the figurehead. So you can blame most things Pac-12 on him. But I don't know that there's been that much tangible stuff that I'd said, yeah, that's really kind of a D-bag move on his part. But some of the stuff Kyle was telling us about the things he said, like you mentioned, that telling the players to drop the COVID protocols facade and to basically stop being greedy, looking for generational wealth. I mean, those are pretty... I guess seemingly insensitive things to say to these guys who appear to be very serious in what they want.
And that is not reading the room correctly, right? And that is not like especially when he called it a PR media stunt.
What is that? I mean, the language he's using with these guys seems totally counterproductive.
Yeah. In reading the room on, hey, this is not something that is going away and it is a growing movement and it's not just your conference that's doing it. Now, I think he was looking at it from the terms of like the Big 12, the ACC and the SEC aren't doing these things. We've had it from the Big 10 and the Mountain West. Those, the three conferences that had at the time of this phone call, which is last Thursday, it was the Big 10, the Mountain West and the Pac-12 were the only conferences that had their players speaking up about these sorts of issues. As of last night, this is where reading the room and seeing kind of the growing sentiment of college athletes before that weekend. Last night, we had the Power Five conferences all came together. You know, a conference call that included the names like Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, Penei Sewell. Those are, in all likelihood, the top three picks in the NFL draft.
Yep.
We're on one conference call about this very topic of health, safety, in the growing push for a college athlete association, not a union, an association.
Right, and these are guys that, honestly, if they don't have a season or sat out, I mean, would it be sad to them? Of course. But they would be fine because eventually they will get drafted by the NFL and they will play there. And the fact that it's these guys who are stepping up saying, hey, we're not just doing this for us. All of our teammates are on board too, but using their voices, I think, is great.
Yes, and it's something that there's a movement brewing, folks, and it's getting bigger and bigger, and it may be one of the litany of reasons, and I do not want to sit there and say this is why college football maybe pushes spring, because it won't be. It is one of the many issues that are kind of coming to a head right now, and it was something that had been growing for years now, decades now, is players wanting to find a voice, and where was that opportunity to have it? And this is it, right? This pandemic has brought out a lot of the flaws in a lot of businesses, in a lot of facets of, in walks of our life. And in college sports, it has really become glaring and apparent that it is a flawed system. And the athletes are finding a voice and they know that they can talk about these things openly now. And they're using it. And so I applaud these young people for doing it because, look, a lot of it too is that there's a lot of pressure from adults that you respect, that you love, your coaches, administrators. You know, even there's going to be a lot of these guys that have relatives that are like, what are you doing? And they're still confident and comfortable enough to go out and do it. And hey, more power to you guys. I don't know how this ends, but it's going to be a situation where the college football season doesn't look like it's going to happen in the fall. It's not because of the players trying to find a voice for their health and safety, though. It is because the university presidents, the ADs, the commissioners, they don't feel comfortable with what's going on and pushing through with the season. All right, let's get to the Blazers, shall we? We still have to talk about the Astros, and we will, because my beloved Houston Astros franchise, boy, they are unlikable. And it is getting worse and worse by the day, and it's becoming harder and harder to root for them. We'll talk about what they did, Bush League, over the weekend, and that will end the show. But coming up next, the biggest flaws and bright spots of the weekend for the Portland Trail Blazers. Feel free, light up the text line, 503-250-1080. Here's Buck with SportsCenter. Hi, Portland Trail Blazers sit just a half game back of the eighth and final playoff seed for the Western Conference playoffs. Down in the bubble in Orlando, it has been good to the Blazers. They are 4-2 through their first six games. Gary Trent Jr. has been electric, and he has been a force off the bench, both offensively and on the defensive end of the floor. He has been a bright spot. But you can't say enough about Damian Lillard. And part of our P1 social today was bright spots and big flaws of the Portland Trail Blazers weekend. They go 1-1. And they end up losing a game they had no business losing. Up 5 with a minute 39 to go. The offense went stagnant. They were taking some bad shots, wasted possessions offensively. And then the inability to get a stop on the defensive end is really what doomed the Blazers. It wasn't the fact that Dame missed 2 free throws at the end in the final minute to tie the game and take the lead. Look, the Blazers lean on Damian Lillard. And they lean on him and they lean on him and they lean on him. It's not going to happen every single night. And the fact of the matter is that the Blazers have put themselves in a position where they control their own destiny these final two games. If they can beat Dallas tomorrow and beat Brooklyn Thursday, then the Blazers will be a playoff team and have a shot to play in the play-in, right?
And they have earned that. They've put themselves in that spot. You mentioned it earlier when we saw them going to the bubble. We thought it might be an uphill climb, but they have done enough so far to put themselves in position to be there, and they've earned that right.
And here's a great thing that the NBA just announced this morning, according to Jason Quick of The Athletic. He said Portland-Brooklyn will be at 6 o'clock Pacific time, and on TNT is the second part of the doubleheader on Thursday. What that means is that Milwaukee plays Memphis at 1. San Antonio, Utah will be at 3:30. The Blazers will know by the time their game tips off on Thursday whether or not they are in that playoff game or they need to win that game. And desperation could be a hell of a thing. And look, that's going 4-2 in those first six games. I think one thing we've seen is that it's not easy to win in the bubble. We've had the Bucks have their hiccups. The Clippers have. The Lakers have had their hiccups. in 4-2 is nothing to be disappointed in. It's just kind of the way that it happened on Saturday that is really frustrating for a lot of Blazer fans. Inability to come up with stops and play on the defensive end. That was frustrating as all get out. And then it looked as if the same thing was happening yesterday against Philly.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's one of those things where there have been situations, though, where it looked like they maybe weren't going to pull out games or they needed a little bit extra late to be able to pull games out in this stretch. And listen, the restart at times has been clunky for everyone. So to expect them to roll in and maybe go 7-1 in those 8 games, probably not realistic. But at least against the Celtics in that game, they were so hot early and you went down by so much early. You can understand how you can maybe stomach that loss a little bit better. But for the Blazers to be leading most of that game against the Clippers, to have the lead that they did as late as they did, and then have the fate of the game in your superstar's hands and have it not bounce the right way is tough.
And you would want, just as the 76ers are probably going, hey, one of the best players in the league beat us. Damian Lillard dropped 51 yesterday. As Philly is saying, the best player, one of the best players in the world, probably the best point guard in the NBA, he beat us. He beat us single-handedly on Sunday, and they can live with that because they didn't have Ben Simmons. They didn't have Joel Embiid. That is the frustrating part, though, with the Clipper loss, is that Kawhi Leonard didn't play due to load management. Pat Beverly did not play in that game, and Paul George, was it 5:36 or something in the game, did not play the final 5.5 minutes
of
the game.
It was teed up for him. That's what makes it tough. The Celtics game was not teed up for him. This one was.
And that's the difference between the Blazers being a half game up on Memphis and now a half game back of Memphis for the eighth and final playoff spot. Because, look, beating the same team twice in back-to-back games, that's going to be a really tough ask for anybody. And if you are the 8 seed, you have the advantage where you only have to win one game. If you are the 9 team, you have to win twice.
It is a huge advantage. I mean, I kind of think that this is how like a wild card format in baseball should be. I like it that the team chasing has to win more games than the team ahead. But it makes that Clippers loss seem so much more significant, especially if you're not able to leapfrog Memphis down the stretch here.
And that, I think, is one of the bigger flaws that we saw out of the weekend, is that, you know, there's a lot of love going the Blazers' way, and rightfully so with the way that they've been playing. Nurkic has looked amazing, and Dame has been Dame. Gary Trent has been a revelation for this team. And, you know, CJ McCollum has been consistent, though he's not getting the volume that of shots that he's accustomed to. He's still been consistent on the offensive end, but you still see it's highlighted depth is going to be an issue. Now, having Gary Trent Jr. makes me feel a hell of a lot better about that depth. But we had a text earlier come in. It's been like, you know, I was just thinking how great Trevor Ariza would have been. And, you know, yes.
Certainly could have been helpful at this point in time.
But those depth issues that the Blazers do have has always been the concern about beating a team like the Lakers in the first round. And it will continue to be an issue. You know, next year will be different. And you know what? If anything, this bubble restart has got me feeling a lot better about where the Blazers head into the 2020-2021 season than anything about this year and being in the bubble and making a playoff run, because those pieces will return. And it does look as if Portland is heading in the right direction of, hey, that chemistry, that continuity, it's not going to be a restart rebuild from scratch again, because we saw how easily Nurk can just be inserted into the lineup, and it's a big if, but you sit there and you see the, especially on the defensive end, some of those possessions that Zach Collins can affect in a positive way, even though he's not getting maybe a block shot or a steal or whatever, he's forcing a pass through the lane and creating a turnover for somebody else, right? And those are good building blocks. Still, you want to see a lot more growth, but it's trending in that right direction, especially if Carmelo Anthony still has gas left in the tank and he wants to come back to Portland next year.
Carmelo is, I mean, continues to be this kind of steady, constant presence. And I guess if he's able to fit in this role, I was worried about it before when they added him. And then even initially, I wasn't convinced he was doing that much to help this team. But I think the way that he has kind of, I don't want to say morphed, but the way that he has accepted or embraced the role and the way that the role has kind of embraced him, I think is also kind of contingent on being able to get some of those contributions from Nurk, from Gary Trent Jr. Then Carmelo doesn't have to do quite as much. He doesn't have to put up quite as many shots. And, you know, I don't know how much he's got left in these legs, but if it doesn't take a lot to get up and down the court and shoot, and we know he can do that.
Absolutely. Blazers, again, off today. They play Dallas tomorrow, Brooklyn on Thursday. Meanwhile, Memphis, who they are chasing, has Boston and Milwaukee in their final two games. So if a setback happens for Memphis against the Boston Celtics, then that'll come down to, you know, can the Blazers win their final two games, and they will be the eight seed and have that advantage. Still, though, they only have a half game up on San Antonio, who's got Houston and Utah remaining, and a full game up on Phoenix, which has got three games remaining: Oklahoma City, Philly, and Dallas. They play OKC today, and apparently there's a laundry list of OKC players that are going to be out for that one. So I think it's going to be Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Steven Adams, Andre Robertson, Danilo Gallinari are all going to be out for Oklahoma City as they take on Phoenix. And look, can Phoenix capitalize? Because they're a young and inexperienced team, and we saw just because those stars aren't playing doesn't mean that you can't trip up in the bubble, because they have flaws just like Portland and San Antonio and Memphis. And San Antonio, man, Greg Popovich, everybody wrote them off when LaMarcus Aldridge didn't come to the bubble.
But you knew they were built for this. Mm-hmm. A Greg Popovich team in a weird scenario where everyone's trying to acclimate. I just felt like the writing was on the wall with what he's done and with some of the players. Like, even recently, some of the playoff runs that they have made as they've started to lose or see their superstars phase out of the league. I mean, I remain impressed with what he is able to do, especially, like you said, considering their best player was lost for this restart, and they came out here smashing people right out of the gate.
Yep. All right, 503-250-1080. I'm coming to grips with the fact that I dislike my favorite team, which is a hard thing to do, and I never thought I'd do it as a sports fan. Dusty and Cam. All right. We got this. I do not like what my favorite team is doing.
Every single guy over there needs a beating.
That's right, Nick Markakis. The Houston Astros have not handled their cheating scandal well at all. That's become apparent because of the way that they handled their press conference to address it during spring training. The fact that the blow up with the Dodgers, like, we all expected that to happen. And at that point, you just kind of shut up and you go ahead and you play. Well, it got even uglier over the weekend. And this is where I just sit there and I go, man, come on, guys. Like, you root for a team your whole life, and you have a connection with that team throughout your whole life, and you pull for them. And I will love the Astros forever. They are unlikable as all get out, especially after this weekend where Alex Cintron, the hitting coach for the Astros, he had words for, was it?
Ramon Laureano.
Ramon Laureano of the A's, who the Astros plunked three times over the weekend. And twice in yesterday's game, he wore one in the numbers. I don't know what Ramon Laureano did to Houston. I don't know where the bad blood is there. I don't know if all three were intentional or not. But
the last one was only 78 miles an hour, and it looked like a breaking ball. But Laureano was motioning to the pitcher afterwards, basically saying, like, showing him a hand motion, like, I know you guided that breaking ball at me. Yes, it was a breaking ball. But, and so you're going to say you didn't try to, but I saw what you're doing with your hand and you tried to do that.
But you just sit there and you go, my God, guys, why? And then he starts John at the Astros dugout in Cintron, who's not a player. He's a hitting coach. He escalates it into a bench clearing brawl where there should be no team in baseball that is starting a bench clearing brawl more than the Houston Astros. Like, they have no reason to start the brawl, right? I would get it if the 29 other teams in baseball wanted to go out and fight them, but having the lack of awareness to jaw from your dugout at any point this season is mind-blowing to me.
Well, and what the hell is Cintron doing trying to escalate that anyways? If his job as a coach, especially now in a pandemic, should be to diffuse this thing, to try to protect his guys by not letting there be a confrontation. And instead, he's sitting there pulling his mask down, screaming at Laureano on first base.
And that is where I sit there and I go, look, the hammer's going to be dropped. And Major League Baseball, I think you're going to finally get your way, folks. Multiple Astros will be suspended for this, and they should be.
And they should be.
Because right after the Dodgers thing with the Astros, a memo was sent, you under no circumstances come out of the dugout. That's the last thing that we want to do and what last thing we want to happen. And here we are a couple weeks later, and it's like, all right, back at it again. And I love the memes out there. They're like, oh, we know Rob Manfred will just suspend Joe Kelly 8 more games for this, which is funny because, look, he should not have been suspended 8 games. And I don't know how that was upheld, but it was.
Was that a don't fight during the pandemic suspension? And should we expect something similar for Laureano?
Yeah. And not Laureano. Laureano should not. No, give him 4 games. He might deserve 8 games, but the thing is, the Astros should be punished more severely because they were the instigators in all of this. And your crappy bullpen and your lack of pitching is why the Astros aren't very good right now. But you can't afford to lose any arms, so why are you even throwing at guys in the first place? It is just... it's just such a lack of awareness, and it makes it really hard, really hard for me to root for my favorite team.
I mean, even if...
and that makes me sad.
Even if they had been slighted by Laureano at some point, isn't this the year where you just say, all right, we're going to take our licks?
Yes. Yeah, you know what? There's like 2 years where you should do it because you're only playing AL West and NOS teams this year. Next year, you should be on board with, all right, it's going to be a rough year for us, all right? We're going to go 2 years... and for everybody saying that the Astros are getting off easy in this, no. This is just expanding out what should be the brutal run that they have.
Good. So 2 year shame tour.
Sure. Go ahead and do it. But for a team that I loved and they were a lovable loser in this little old, hey, I think they can, even in the 90s, man, they had Biggio, Bagwell, and it was fun to watch. And they were never the greatest team, and they never had these World Series aspirations. They were just a decent, good team with Ken Caminiti at third base doing steroids and I don't know what else. RIP Ken Caminiti. But you just had these guys that they were like a lovable loser type team. And that's why, you know, I built that connection. I pulled for them, and then they took the shortcut through hell. And I was like, oh my gosh, they pulled this off. They did it the right way.
From lovable loser to hateable winner.
Wrong. This is they did not do it the right way. And that sucks as a fan. Because it wasn't like I was jumping on board when they started getting good. It just sucks. But you know what? That's what sports are. In about 15 years, they'll be back to being my lovable losers again.
15 years? That's how long
he's going
to
love them again. Well, yeah, until everybody's gone.
Okay.
Well, long gone in the Astros organization. Because until Altuve, Correa, Bregman, all those guys are out, there's still going to be a lot of hate.
Well, you know who they play tonight, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
We got to do something
Monday
for this.
Night,
I mean,
baseball.
My Giants suck, but this is, they hardly ever play, so this is grounds for some sort of a show bet.
All right.
Is it a 2-game or 3-game series? Do you know?
I don't know, man. I've been so focused on what's happening with the Blazers and in college football.
Yeah.
And then the fact that I'm starting to hate that my own team, I've really not liked where baseball's headed for me. So why don't you check that, because you still have a leg to stand on with loving your team. It's a brutal bastard, this sports thing. Why we care so passionately about our teams when they let us down. All right. We're going to do sandwich bet. Let's do Rip City Grill sandwich bet.
It's lunch at least bet. A 3-gamer.
All right, lunch bet. We're doing sandwich game lunch bet.
God, the Giants aren't going to win 2 of those. I'm going to owe you a sandwich for your hateable team.
The entire Astros organization will probably be suspended.
Let's hope so. Okay. Sandwich bet it is.
All right. Up next, we got The Herd with Colin Cowherd, 9 to noon, noon to 3, during Sprague, 3 to 7. Primetime with Isaac and Suk, and then Duck Insider Joey Mack is back, folks. 7 to 8 p.m. Have a great Monday. We'll see you Tuesday right here on The Fan.